Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. I've got a really interesting set of sources in front of us today, and we're going to unpack an institution that's played just an absolutely vital role for the Kurdish people for, what, over four decades now? The Kurdish Institute of Paris, the KIP.
That's right. We've looked through quite a bit of material, articles, research papers, really digging into how the KIP started, what its core missions are, and frankly, the significant impact it's had. And our goal isn't just to list facts, but to get into why it matters so much. Why is this institute so important, especially, you know, for people without their own state?
Exactly. And I think to really get that, you first have to understand when it was founded. The sources all point to February 1983, and they consistently call it one of the darkest periods in modern Kurdish history.
Precisely. It wasn't just any time. It was this moment of intense crisis, really hitting from all sides. You had the Iran-Iraq war devastating Kurdish areas. Saddam Hussein was ramping up those brutal campaigns in Iraq, the ones that would lead to Anfal.
Yeah.
And then in Iran, after the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini actually declared a holy war on Iranian Kurds. And add to that, Turkey. After the 1980 military coup, there was severe repression, mass arrests, and, crucially, that ban on the Kurdish language and culture.
Wow. So just immense pressure, immense danger. And that must have triggered, well, a wave of people having to flee. Intellectuals,
yeah.
Activists.
A huge wave. Many sought refuge in Europe. And Paris, actually, especially under the socialist government elected in 81, was seen as, well, more welcoming than some other places.
But finding individual refuge is one thing. What about collectively?
That was the gap. The existing Kurdish groups in Europe were smaller, often focused locally. They just weren't equipped for this sudden influx or for getting the word out internationally about how bad things really were.
Right. And the sources mentioned that the political resistance, such as it was in Europe then, was really fragmented, divided, pretty much inaudible internationally.
That's a key phrase from the material. Inaudible. So into this climate, this existential threat, this political disarray, KIP wasn't just, you know, another cultural center. It was founded as a direct response to what the sources call precise and urgent needs.
So necessity.
Absolutely. The founders weren't just thinking about saving manuscripts. They explicitly wanted a unifying platform, a glimmer of hope, a symbol of Kurdish moral unity for a nation facing just terrible adversity, lacking that cohesive voice. It was about survival, about representation.
And when you look at who the founders were, it really underlines that mission. It wasn't just one kind of person.
No, it was this really distinguished mix. Leading intellectuals, prominent artists.
People like the filmmaker Yılmaz Guney, right? He just won the Palme d'Or.
Exactly. Huge international name recognition right there.
Yeah.
Then you had major poets like Segrikswin and Hejar, linguists like Tufik Wabi, Kanate Kurdo, Hacı Sindi too, painters like Remzi Rasa.
And the writer Hunyurdin Zaza. Plus, the person who's been president right through, Kendall Nazan, who's actually a nuclear physicist.
It was a powerful combination. Guney's recent win gave them instant prestige, a visibility, frankly, that no purely political figure could have offered at that moment. He brought symbolic weight. And then having experts in language, literature, science that gave them the intellectual backbone for the long haul.
It's fascinating how they leveraged that cultural capital right from the get-go. And that seems to have helped attract some really significant Western supporters early on.
Yeah.
Their sponsorship committee.
Yeah, really big names. Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, Bernard Kouchner, and very importantly, Danielle Mitterrand, the wife of the French president at the time.
That kind of backing is significant. It shows it wasn't seen as just some niche ethnic thing.
Exactly. That's another key insight. They framed the Kurdish struggle in terms of universal human rights, cultural rights, the plight of stateless peoples. And Danielle Mitterrand, through her France Libertés Foundation, became a really strong, consistent ally. Supported many KIPI projects over the years. Their involvement just gave KIPI immense credibility and helped amplify its message globally.
Okay, so it starts out of this urgent need, with this powerful mix of founders and supporters. How did it then build itself into something lasting? An institution.
Well, it began, you know, simply enough, registered in 83 under French law as a standard nonprofit association. But a really crucial development happened 10 years later, in 1993. That's when the French Prime Minister issued a decree recognizing KIP as a Fondation Reconnue d'Utilité Publique.
A foundation of public benefit. What does that status actually mean in practical terms?
It's a big deal in France. Getting that recognition is a tough process. It signifies a high level of official trust that the institution's work is seen as important for the public good, and crucially, it gives them enhanced legal stability, more legitimacy. plus a very practical benefit. Donations to KIPP become tax deductible in France. That's vital for fundraising.
And their structure even reflects this close tie, right? Links to the French.
Yes, the governance shows that. Okay. They have a 15-member board of directors, and it includes representatives appointed directly by the French Ministries of Culture and the Interior. And as we mentioned, Kendall Nazan has provided that incredible continuity as president. They also have a cultural and scientific council drawn from diaspora intellectuals, which connects them to the community and also elects the board.
So they built the institutional base. But the sources also really go into KIPP's extensive history of advocacy, almost like diplomatic work, on the world stage.
They really did step into roles you'd normally expect a state to fill. A key early example was that international conference they organized in Paris in 1989, right after the Halabja chemical attack.
Right, trying to make the world pay attention.
Exactly. They brought together Kurdish representatives from all four parts of Kurdistan, plus delegations from 32 countries. And crucially, they managed to get serious engagement from both the U.S. and the Soviet Union.
That sounds incredibly strategic. Didn't they follow that up with events in the U.S. and Moscow, too?
Yes, and this really highlights their unique function. In February 91, just after the first Gulf War, they held this pivotal conference, actually, in the U.S. Senate. They had eight leading senators there, people like Ted Kennedy, John Kerry meeting with key Kurdish leaders, Jalal Talabani, Hoshar Zebari.
Wow.
And the sources strongly suggest that KIPP's work there, their advocacy, was instrumental in persuading the U.S. government to back U.N. Resolution 688.
The resolution that created the safe haven for Iraqi Kurds.
The very one. So you see them directly influencing major geopolitical outcomes.
Incredible.
And they did something similar in Moscow in 1990, focused on the situation of Kurds in the Soviet Union, actually with support from Gorbachev's government. That conference also helped ensure Soviet support for Resolution 688. They were acting as high-level connectors, advocates.
And it wasn't just about high politics. They pushed hard on cultural rights, too, like tackling that language ban in Turkey.
Yes, that's another major achievement the sources point to. In 1988, they launched an international appeal for the defense of Kurdish culture in Turkey. They gathered 1,000 signatures from international figures, Nobel laureates, U.S. senators. Got it published widely. This created significant pressure that, well, contributed to President Özal eventually abolishing those language ban laws in 1991.
They also championed specific individuals, didn't they? Like advocating for those jailed Kurdish MPs who later won the Sakharov Prize.
Absolutely. They led the international campaign for people like Leyla Zana, set up an international defense committee, really popularized their cause. That advocacy was key to the European Parliament awarding her the Sakharov Prize. They also supported conferences trying to find peaceful ways forward, like one in Oslo in 1995, focused on the situation in Turkey.
It really does sound like they were performing functions you'd normally associate with, I don't know, a foreign ministry or a cultural ministry of an actual state.
For a stateless nation, that's exactly the point the sources make. KIPP filled a critical vacuum. Now, over time, Kurdish political groups, especially in Iraqi Kurdistan, developed their own international representation. But KIPP didn't disappear. It adapted.
How did that adaptation look? What did they focus on then?
They shifted to put even more intense focus on those core cultural and intellectual missions, cultural preservation, really deep work on linguistic development, supporting academics and students, training what the sources call the next generation of Kurdish secular elites.
Still relevant then.
Absolutely. The sources confirm they just celebrated the 40th anniversary in 2023, which is a testament to that continued relevance. And even very recently, they were involved in lobbying the French National Assembly, which adopted a motion condemning Turkey's incursion into Afrin.
Okay, so even as the external political landscape shifted, these core tasks, preserving language, culture, and knowledge, remained absolutely central.
Foundational. And their work specifically on the Kurdish language is really quite groundbreaking.
Oh, Hannah the Shy Lady is here. Rojbash Hannah.
Rojbash Hannah.
You know, one of the best parts of doing this work is getting a good cup of chai.
Yes, let's see how it is today.
Sounds of receiving sipping chai. This is good today. Perfectly sweet.
Yes, just right. Not bitter at all. Perfect fuel to keep discussing this vital institution.
Absolutely. All right, back to it. You are highlighting their crucial work on the Kurdish language.
Yes, it's really a cornerstone for them. They offer structured language courses, mainly in the two big dialects, Kurmanji and Sorani, beginner, intermediate levels. And importantly, these are open to everyone, diaspora members, researchers, French people, anyone interested.
And I noticed in the notes, they also offered French courses for Kurdish immigrants.
Yes, that holistic view is important, helping people integrate into French life while at the same time working so hard to preserve and develop the mother tongue. It is worth mentioning, though, that while KIPP's courses are incredibly valuable and accessible, the University INALSO, also here in Paris, is unique in offering a full degree program in Kurdish. So KIPP's courses are supplementary in that sense, but vital nonetheless.
Okay, but beyond just teaching, the sources talk about major contributions to linguistic research and standardization. That sounds like a massive undertaking for a non-state actor.
It is. This is where they've effectively acted like a state language academy. Since way back in 1987, they've run these intensive week-long linguistic seminars twice a year. They bring together Kurdish writers, linguists, journalists from all over the diaspora. They collect vocabulary, analyze dialect differences, and this is critical. They actively work on developing new terminology.
New words.
For what?
For modern life. Sure. Science, technology, politics, computing, all the areas where a language needs contemporary terms to stay relevant and functional. They're essentially doing language planning and engineering.
So ensuring Kurdish can be a language for the 21st century.
Precisely. And they don't just do the work, they spread it through their linguistic magazine, Kurmanji. Publishing this consistently for decades has been absolutely crucial for helping to standardize the Kurmanji dialect across different regions and borders where Kurds live.
And the dictionary projects fit into this too.
Yes, major efforts. They published a big Kurdish-French dictionary, 85,000 entries apparently, and there's a Kurdish-Turkish one planned or perhaps out by now. They've even supported work on less common dialects like Sezaki. This linguistic focus, it's not just academic navel-gazing. It directly supports education, media, cultural life for millions.
Okay, shifting gears slightly to culture more broadly. KIPP isn't just about language seminars and dictionaries. It sounds like a pretty vibrant cultural hub.
Oh, absolutely. They actively cultivate and showcase Kurdish heritage through a really wide range of events. Concerts, traditional and contemporary music, film screenings, art exhibitions showing everything from, you know, traditional crafts to modern paintings, poetry readings, comedy nights, even food events.
It sounds vital for keeping the culture alive and fostering connection, especially for the diaspora.
Hugely important. These events give artists a platform. They celebrate and help preserve what the sources explicitly call an endangered culture. And maybe most importantly, they build community cohesion. They help pass the culture on to younger generations born outside Kurdistan. The annual Paris Kurdish Cultural Festival, which they often run with the Paris City Hall, is a big public-facing example of this, sharing the richness of Kurdish culture with a wider audience.
And then there's what sounds like the scholarly heart of the institution.
Yeah.
The library and archives. The sources call it the largest and most comprehensive collection on Kurds in Kurdistan in the Western world. That's quite a claim.
It is a big claim, but based on the descriptions, it seems credible. We're talking over 12,000 books in like 23, 25 languages, tens of thousands of documents, rare old newspapers and magazines, photos, videos, sound recordings. It's an immense repository.
Who actually uses this library?
It's described as indispensable. Students, academic researchers from all over the world, journalists writing about Kurdish issues, NGOs needing background information. Even major media outlets like the BBC or Arte apparently use their archives for historical context or footage. It really positions KIPP as the central node of knowledge about the Kurds for the rest of the world.
And making so much of it digital must have been a game changer. The BNK.
The Kurdish Digital Library, yes, absolutely transformative. Over 1 million pages digitized and put online, supported by the Olof Palme Foundation, apparently. Think what that means. It just democratizes access completely. A student or a researcher in Kurdistan or anywhere else in the diaspora who could never physically get to Paris can now access this vast resource. It functions as this vital, accessible, global archive of Kurdish knowledge and memory.
It makes perfect sense that an institution with that kind of library would also be directly involved in supporting academic work itself.
Yes, they've clearly invested heavily in human capital over the years, provided scholarships to hundreds of students historically. They had a specific program supporting over 540 Kurdish students to get higher education, often in French universities. The stated goal was explicitly about training future secular elites.
And the sources mention a particular focus now.
Yes, currently their priority seems to be supporting PhD candidates. They had 25 as of late 2023, and there's a really noteworthy detail here regarding gender equality.
Oh, wow.
17 of those 25 PhD candidates are women, mainly from Turkey and Iran. Kippy explicitly connects this focus on women's education to building a free and democratic future for Kurdish society. It's a very clear, progressive commitment woven into their academic support.
And they foster academic exchange, too, presumably.
Definitely. Hosting major events like the World Congress of Kurdish Studies just underlines their role as a central hub for developing the field globally.
So they're gathering all this knowledge, supporting scholars. How do they actually get this information, this research, out into the world?
Publications are a huge part of it. They have several key periodicals. One is the Bulletin de Liaison et d'Information. It's monthly in French and English. It summarizes international press coverage of Kurdish issues, but also adds analytical commentary. It goes out globally and is considered this unique, essential database stretching all the way back to 1983. Imagine the archives that represents.
That sounds incredibly useful for anyone trying to follow this complex international story over time.
It really does. Then there's Krummansi, the linguistic magazine we already talked about, crucial for language development. And Etudes Kurdes, which is their French language research journal, providing a platform for more in-depth scholarly articles.
The sources did mention some journals had to be suspended, though. That hints at challenges.
Yes. Titles like Heavy and Studia Kurdica were stopped due to financial constraints. It shows they had ambition, but also highlights their vulnerability to funding issues. Beyond the periodicals, they've published a lot of important books over the years. Linguistic works, like grammars. Editions of classic Kurdish literature, like Emedirizani's Mem Uzin. And translations, both into Kurdish and from Kurdish.
The translations into Kurdish sound particularly significant.
Extremely. Translating the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and then, with UNESCO's help, printing and distributing 50,000 copies in Iraqi Kurdistan. That's a major undertaking with real impact. They also translate important works about Kurds or by Kurds into French, making things like Leyla Zana's prison writings accessible to a wider international audience, or Mehdi Zana's book about Diyarbakir prison.
And then there's that amazing detail about the school textbooks.
Yes, that is one of the most striking examples of KIPP acting almost like a state agency. They partnered on a huge project to produce and distribute 385,000 school textbooks.
385,000?
Yes, in Kurdish. For primary and secondary kids in Iraqi Kurdistan. Covering all sorts of subjects.
That's not just publishing. That's practically functioning as a ministry of education, facilitating mother tongue education on a massive scale.
It really is. It just underscores their deep commitment to building capacity and supporting education, especially where state structures might have been lacking or unable to provide it in Kurdish. And they don't just stick to print. They use audiovisual media, too. They've produced music recordings, cassettes back in the day, CDs later preserving traditional music, featuring specific artists, collections of women's voices, vital work for intangible heritage, and documentaries, too, on Kurdish history, culture, political figures like Yılmaz Guni or Leyla Zana, even preserving things like the Kurdish theater in Truisi, reaching different audiences, educating, giving artists platforms.
Okay, so let's try and pull all these threads together. Looking at everything KIPP does, the language work, the culture, the library, the advocacy, the publications, what's the overall impact? How has it shaped Kurdish identity, particularly in the diaspora?
Well, it's clearly served as a crucial cultural anchor, a powerful symbol of resilience that emerged from that really dark period. It offered that glimmer of hope and became a symbol of Kurdish moral unity. For Kurds in the diaspora, it's provided this incredibly important space, physical and intellectual, to connect with their language, their history, their heritage, through the courses, the events, that amazing library.
And creating what the sources call a nonpartisan public space must be really essential, given that the Kurdish community is spread across different countries, often with different political allegiances.
Absolutely critical. It's a rare and valuable kind of space where Kurds from diverse backgrounds can come together around a shared sense of identity, of Kurdishness. And as we noted, they also actively support integration into host societies like France, while simultaneously working to preserve that distinct identity. It's a dual function.
And beyond the diaspora itself, what about KIPP's influence on academic Kurdish studies and maybe public understanding more broadly?
Oh, the impact there has been immense. That library alone makes it an indispensable resource, drawing scholars from everywhere. Their publications, especially the decades of linguistic work, have had a profound shaping effect on the academic field and, importantly, on the actual development and standardization of the language itself. And then through their documentation center, their press monitoring in the bulletin, their engagement with media, and those really targeted advocacy campaigns we discussed, they've been absolutely instrumental in educating non-Kurdish audiences, policymakers, writers, journalists, actively shaping how the Kurdish people and their issues are understood internationally.
But despite this incredible track record and obvious importance, the sources are also quite blunt about the challenges Kip faces.
Yes, financial sustainability comes up again and again as a persistent and serious challenge. They operate, apparently, with very modest financial means. The sources even use stark language, saying Kip is sometimes at risk of disappearing and relies heavily on public appeals and donations.
And their principal stance on where they won't take money from must make that harder.
It certainly does. They explicitly state they refuse aid from states known to oppress Kurds, or from non-democratic states in general. Now, that's an ethical position, but it definitely limits the pool of potential major donors. So relying on fluctuating public grants, private donations, combined with broader economic pressures like French austerity measures over the years, it's had real impacts, like those journals being suspended. Even though they own their building and have some endowment, it seems it's just not enough to fully cover the costs of all the vital work they do.
So here they are, over 40 years on, still standing, still clearly vital, but facing this constant struggle for resources.
That's the picture. The need for an institution like KIPP definitely persists, especially perhaps for engaging younger generations in the diaspora who might feel more distant from their heritage. They're continuing their core missions. That 40th anniversary celebration wasn't just looking back. It was an assertion of their ongoing importance.
And they clearly have a vision for what more they could do if the resources were there.
Yes, the sources definitely convey that. With greater financial stability, KIPA believes it could significantly expand its work, really focus on cultivating a more informed, organized, and influential global Kurdish diaspora, which, you know, numbers over 2 million people worldwide. They see themselves continuing as that unique, independent, secular, pan-Kurdish cultural and intellectual hub, but potentially on an even bigger scale, really building future capacity for the Kurdish nation.
So looking at everything we've explored in these sources today, the Kurdish Institute of Paris really emerges as this incredibly multifaceted force.
Absolutely. It's been a guardian of culture, a catalyst for language development, a vital academic center, and remarkably an effective international advocate for a stateless people, showing incredible resilience and impact ever since it was founded in that moment of deep crisis.
Thinking about that, considering the absolutely vital role institutions like KIPP play preserving identity, fostering intellectual capital, providing a voice and structure for communities scattered across borders, what does their ongoing struggle for financial sustainability tell us about the value we, as a global society, truly place on cultural survival, on independent knowledge creation, and on supporting the future capacity of stateless nations in our modern world?